Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction movie that I watch as I watch it. There's no set schedule. Actually, we're not going to review every single science fiction movie, but one came out which I have been waiting to watch for a long, long time, and I did a few weeks ago, and then I thought, well, I want Juliana to see this movie as well with me. So, of course, Juliana is here joining me in this discussion.
Hello.
And the movie that I watched is Arrival. And I've been wanting to watch this for a long time, and I know I have because there's been a few podcasts that I have sitting on in my podcast player, literally since like the end of last year, maybe 5 or 6 months or whenever it came, whenever the movie came out. It came out in 2016.
Yes, it did.
And there was a podcast by the Incomparable podcast, which I often enjoy. I mean, I mostly just listen to episodes about books or movies or something that I've read. You know,
yeah.
It's normally I'll just stick with things that I've read. And often they talk about things that I'm not interested in. But this one I was like, I will definitely watch that movie. And I'll come back to this podcast and listen to it because I knew I'd watch the movie. It's just we were like, hey, maybe watch it in the theater. And then we just never got round to it. I can't remember why, but I don't know.
It just went past, kind of.
Yeah.
And we watched it just yesterday.
Well, let me say, I watched it a few weeks ago.
Yes.
Like 2 weeks ago. And then I was like, great, now I've got these episodes of podcasts to listen to. So I listened to the Incomparable podcast episode. And I was like, oh, that's good. But they didn't really touch on some of the things that I would have touched on. And then I listened to another podcast. Again, another podcast featuring John Siracusa, who was also on the episode of the Incomparable podcast called... I can't remember the name of the podcast. I just have it here. It's called
Something
Reconcilable Differences. And they talked about this thing at the end of an episode. So I listened all the way to the end of the episode and now we're at the spoiler spot. So, which is very difficult to say. And now we're at the spoiler spot. So don't listen further on in this podcast unless you've watched the movie Arrival. So I paused it and I was sitting there with like an hour of that podcast completed with like 30 minutes not completed. And that was kind of follow-up from what they were saying on the Incomparable podcast. And then they still didn't get to one of the things that I wanted to talk about. And then they did that again in the next episode. And actually just this morning, I just listened to the first 10 minutes of another episode, literally 5 months later. And they said, hey, someone sent us this video. So I also showed a little video, like a follow-up video of like the script writing video, which you just watched like 4 minutes ago, 5 minutes
right,
ago.
Right, right.
And now, weirdly enough, at the time that we were planning on watching this, because we were planning, hey, let's watch the movie this week, read the short story that this movie is based on, and as we were doing that, as we were making these plans, oh, let's watch it on like Tuesday or Wednesday whenever we watch the movie, then the SFF Audio podcast comes out with their own podcast about it, and I've only listened to the first half an hour on that, and again, they didn't touch on the things that I wanted to touch on about the movie yet. Well, I don't think they will because they're kind of going off into different areas.
All right.
So let's talk a little bit about
What's this film and what does it have to do with a book?
Oh, yeah, okay. So there was a short story written in 1998, yes. It was nominated for some awards in 2000 and 1999, written by Ted Chiang, and it's called The Story of Your Life, or Story of Your Life, not The Story of Your Life, Story of Your Life. And it's the title book in a collection called The Story of Your Life and Others.
Yes.
Oh, sorry, Stories of Your Life and Others. So it's called Story of Your Life, but it's in a collection called Stories of Your Life and Others. In other words, stories, that story and other books. And I've read and reviewed that short story collection on this podcast before. And in a few minutes after Juliana said her experience of reading this short story in a German collection, I'll tell you what episode that is. Go.
So it turns out I read a Ted Chiang book last year, actually.
Was it just last year?
Okay. Yeah, last year. And so I read this because it was on the free ebooks on my library app.
Yeah.
And I got it out and I thought, oh, I've seen this book, Luke had it as a paper book, The Stories of Your Life and Others.
Yeah, the front
and
cover thought, you recognized.
I recognized the front cover and I thought, oh, that's Ted Chiang. I'm just going to read this German ebook because I thought, that's probably it. So I read it, I really enjoyed it, and then yesterday we watched this movie.
Oh yeah, this is what happened, and you said, which one of the stories is it? And I was like, don't look into it, let's just watch the movie, because if you don't remember what the story is about, that's probably good, because then there's, you know, you won't have in your brain what's coming up. I watched the movie, and I remembered the story, so there were no twists, there were no turns, there was no reveals, which I didn't already see coming, and right from the beginning, I kind of had what the movie was in my head.
Yes.
Whereas it turns out that short story collection didn't have this story in it.
Right. So
it had
what
the life cycle of software objects was its main story.
No. What happened was that in German, they separated this out into two different short story collections, which the book that I've read had quite a few of them in common, which were in the stories of your life and others. But
it had like Understanding and 72 Letters or whatever, it, you know, that some of those other things in that short story collection.
Yeah, let me read it out. I actually have it.
Let me say it here. I reviewed Stories of Your Life and Others, a short story collection, on episode 154 of this podcast back in 2012, February 2012. And you can find that by going to the sfbrp.com and then go to episode lists. And if it's not on the end of the iTunes feed, there is an archive feed. So if you go to the homepage of sfbrp.com and look over on the left-hand side, there's actually something which says archive feed episodes 1 to 300. So if you want to get them into if you don't just want to download the episodes individually, you can just get a feed of it, and it's all of the first 300 episodes. So go check that out. What are you going to say? What's the version in German?
Where's my review of this book?
I don't know. You've got to click my review, my activity. Is there something that says my activity?
No, it's not there.
Oh,
it's
maybe you didn't.
I'm not logged in.
Ah, okay. So
okay. Well, anyway, there were a few of the short stories that were in that collection, but unfortunately, not the one that we actually wanted to talk about and watch the movie. So I went into the movie and I didn't really know anything, but I kind of thought, oh, I know this. Oh, this feels familiar and stuff. But I never actually read the story so far, because this short story was in a different short story collection that was called
Hell is the Absence of God.
Exactly.
That is one of the stories which is in the collection Stories of Your Life and others.
Exactly.
So that's why I was getting confused. I was like, no, you have read it. But it was good in a way that you say, no, I want to look up if I've read this. I was like, you know what? Don't. I'm going to put the movie on. And in fact, that was better for you, because I think you got like a fresher experience that you didn't know. Like, I could have said, oh yeah, it's the one about the person who can blah, blah, blah. And I could have just given away the whole movie. I could have just given away what the movie was about.
But I really had no clue. I didn't know anything. So in opposition to Luke, how he got the story into him, he read the short story first and then listened to some podcast. No. And then you watched the movie.
Yeah, okay. I read the short story in 2012.
Yeah.
And then in 2017, I watched the movie.
Yeah.
Then I listened to lots of podcasts about people talking about the movie. Then I, just yesterday or 2 days ago, I said it and actually read the short story again.
Yes.
And then I watched the movie again, and now we're talking about it.
Exactly.
You know it.
Yeah.
So,
and I did it this way. I didn't read it last year.
Yeah.
I watched the movie yesterday, and yesterday evening after the movie, and this morning I just read the short story.
Yeah. So you kind of were digesting the movie by reading the short story that it was based on.
Yes.
Anyway, all of that to say, it's a long introduction to say, before we, because we're going to go like full spoilers in this, so really you should have both read the movie and, both watched the movie and read the book, or read the short story. It's actually only a short story. It took you like an hour and a half to finish it off or something like that.
It's a PDF with 33 pages.
Well, okay, don't say that we downloaded the PDF from a dodgy Russian book sharing site. I paid for that book ages ago. I'm okay with reading it again as a PDF download. But whatever, I'm just saying, check it out. And I would suggest in the end, watch the movie first, because I do think you can get a better experience out of watching the movie, even though I didn't have this experience. Seeing your experience of reading the book, you had seeing your experience of watching the movie, I feel was kind of like the true experience of what the movie makers wanted you to, the journey that you went through as a movie watcher was the journey that they want you to go on.
Yes.
And people who have read the short story before, like me, I still enjoyed the movie. And in fact, I enjoyed it in some ways. I enjoyed it more than the short story. Even now, reading the short story and watching the movie again, there's still parts of the movie which I enjoy more than the short story.
To me, it feels like a different approach. And
I'm just saying, the experience, let me just say this, the experience of reading the short story, there are no spoilers. I mean, there's one or two reveals as you go through, but there's nothing to spoil. There's no twist, there's no development of the story, which makes you think, oh, I didn't expect that. Oh, I thought it was this way. The short story doesn't have a twist, doesn't have a reveal in it as such, story-wise.
No, it's and comes in.
Okay, again, we don't need to... But the point is, the movie does have it. So even knowing all of the movie, you can still read the book in a way that the author of the book, Ted Chiang, expects you to read, because right there on the first page, in the first few paragraphs of the book, it explains what the book is about and the whole setup and what the timeline is doing and all that kind of stuff, and the time stuff going on. Like, yeah. It's explained in the very beginning of the book. The movie doesn't do that. It's revealed as we go through. The character discovers this journey, and we go on a journey of discovery with the character. Yeah. The book doesn't have that. So I do think, watch the movie first, because the book isn't expecting twists and turns, or I won't even say twists, but reveals. You know, the character journey is different in the book, and you can still get that. You can still get 100% of that journey of the character in the book after watching the movie, because when you watch the movie and then read the book, it pretty much says at the start of the, you know, it pretty much says at the start of the book, okay, imagine that you've just watched this movie. Well, it doesn't say that, but like, you know, imagine that you know all of this stuff already.
Yeah.
Now let's tell a story. So also, watch the movie, then read the short story.
Also, it is interesting, especially on our knowledge about the previous books that we just read, you know, the books that take the reader on the same journey and the same emotional journey, like the characters.
Yeah.
And I think this does the movie a lot more than it does in the book.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. This is my main reason why I like the movie more. And setting aside the amazing writing in the book, in the short story, when I read it for the first time, I thought it was one of the weaker stories in the short story collection. In Stories of Your Life and Others, even though it was the title story, mainly because I thought the scientific ideas in it were like, I was just like, okay, I can kind of see what you're doing there. And now, this is the main thing that I want to talk about later, maybe I didn't see what he was going for. I thought maybe he was being more clever than he was, but then I didn't really get an emotional reaction out of it. It was beautiful, there were some beautiful scenes, but I didn't really feel the emotion. It was very, very distancing for me to read it, even though it was very much a story about, you know, a mother and a child and all that kind of stuff. I didn't really get the emotional reaction out of that. And all the other stories in that short story collection, or most of the other stories, aren't based around me having an emotional connection to it, to the story. It's more of an intellectual or horror or these other kind of things. And this felt like an attempt at something to be very emotional, and I didn't really get the emotion out of it, and so I kind of felt like it didn't succeed on its own terms of being an emotional storytelling.
Yeah.
However, I know lots of other people read the book and were devastated. This was even before the movie came out. I've read lots of other people have that emotional response to the book, the short story. I didn't get it. However, when I watched the movie, I didn't last night, but when I watched it, well, a little bit, I teared up, like, in three different places when I watched the movie for the first time. I was really in tears. And while there's movie-making aspects and story things that have changed in the movie, I had a way stronger emotion. I think it's just to do with the acting. Like, the acting and the soundtrack especially, and the editing and the camera work and all the cinematography and all the cinema-making stuff that goes into it, I had a really strong emotional reaction to the movie, which I didn't get from the book. And even then, reading the story again over the last few days before watching the movie again, I once again said, yeah, it is, while there's nice writing in the short story, I still feel more distant from the experience of the author in the book, because we get it's kind of like at the end of the story, kind of retelling. We're not going on the journey with her. It's sort of like, oh, I just remember this happening and this happening. Whereas in the movie, we really go on the journey with the main character as she starts understanding what's going on. And I really got that. I got a lot more out of the movie in that way. The framing of the movie, I think, is better than the book.
I think, especially just watching this little documentary-style explanation about the screenplay, I think this short story is a very, very good basis for a movie screenplay.
Yeah.
Including all the extra bits to make it fit for a movie, which I totally understand, because the book is talking from a more distant point of view, looking backwards And it's not like this.
Yeah, it's not the immediacy of like, yeah, this is what it felt like to be in this situation. Right. It's sort of like, oh, let me tell you how I remember it was,
yes,
back then.
Exactly. You know. It feels a bit more like a diary entry, you know, like a letter from the future into the past, and,
yeah,
and this kind of,
yeah,
like knowing everything in one go.
Yeah.
And I think this is also what makes it so good and suitable to make a movie out of it.
Is that it can be revealed bit
exactly,
by bit. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. So, and I think also,
sorry,
to my point,
okay,
I let you speak for a long time. Also, I think what I was impressed, even though it was, I didn't get that strong of an emotional reaction like as I got in the movie as well. I thought it was brilliantly done, the way that I was thinking, like, is he transsexual? The way that he wrote from her point of view, the way that she talks about her child was very touching to me.
Yeah.
Because she had this very rational view on her child, like talking about like, I didn't sign up for this kind of,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I give birth to something and then I have a living voodoo puppet of myself,
yeah,
which
I
can't influence.
When I give birth to someone, I feel all of my child's pain, but I have no control over her actions.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, this is going to hurt you. Don't. Oh, and then you feel that same
exactly
pain.
And then she said, that wasn't in the contract. I didn't sign up for that.
Yeah.
So it's very intellectually approached. But on the other hand,
well, she's a scientist.
She's a scientist.
Or an intellect, an academic.
But also she's,
yeah,
a woman.
Yeah.
And she's describing how she sees this,
yes,
child the day after.
Yeah.
And then says, oh, and the way that you were moving your legs, I could see now what I was feeling inside.
Yeah, when I was pregnant, you were kicking,
yeah,
your legs this way. And now I see you kicking the legs that,
yeah,
way. And it's like, oh, that's what I was feeling. Now I understand.
And this is a brilliant thought,
yeah,
to me. I mean, I'm a woman, but I don't have children, and,
yeah,
and this was very, very sensitive.
Impactful. That's what I'm saying. The writing is really amazing in the book. However, because of that emotional distance, I,
yeah,
never made that final emotional connection with the book. Whereas,
yeah,
in the movie, I got that emotional connection right, you know, in that first opening of the movie, right there. Okay, but I don't want to, because I want to set off the spoiler horn, get to the spoiler spot.
Okay.
And really get into this. But I just say, I really, no matter, and I'll go into this in a bit, I do have some issues with the movie making-wise and story-wise, which I want to get into. But that doesn't mean I don't think you should be watching the movie. I definitely think watch the movie first, get the full experience of the story from the character's point of view, and then afterwards read the short story and get the full experience of the story from the author's point of view, like the original author's vision of what the story,
yeah,
was.
And the story ideas that,
yeah,
created
greater. Like I say,
bigger and
don't
more
read
detail.
The short story first. Watch the movie. The,
yeah,
movie experience is designed for people who don't know the story. The short story experience doesn't have an opinion either way if you know what's going to happen later on, because it says what's going to happen right at the very start of the short story.
Yes.
So it already says this is going to happen. Okay, spoiler horn, go. That's not what it sounds like.
I know.
Anyway, so let's go straight into this. Let me look into my notes, because before I thought you were wrapping up one point before. I didn't mean to interrupt, because you were coming to the end of one point and then you had another point to make. So
okay.
I was just, before you made that other point, I wanted to get to spoiler spot. But you did it. You got through it. You navigated it pretty well. Okay.
Yeah.
So big thing. Story. What have you got? You've only got a few notes. So
I've only got a few.
Okay.
I wanted to talk about the title of the movie and the title of the book, because
okay.
they changed. I saw it on the Wikipedia page still in like
in,
2016, just before
yeah.
the movie came out. They then the original idea was to call the movie just the same
Story of Your Life.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then just before it came out, they changed the title to Arrival.
Yeah.
Do you think that was a good?
I think it's
point?
A really, really clever play on words.
Yeah.
Like there's so many times in the movie, like it literally the movie opens with saying, "I thought this was where your story starts." And it's the, you know, it's the night, like right at the start, we see those two glasses of wine on the table.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, who are these two people? And then we're like, and then she, later on, she's living in this thing by herself, in that, you know,
same
in the house by herself.
Yeah.
So I like the playing around with time and stuff. Oh, yeah. Now we're just going to assume that you've seen the movie. We're not going to explain too much about it. But the whole point is that is the arrival the aliens arriving? Because that happens early on. Is it, you know, in some point, what happens now? They arrive, you know, there's another point. Is it the arrival of understanding in
yeah.
her head, or is it the arrival of the you know, when's the arrival, or when was the, you know, when you're talking about babies, you actually use that word to say about babies turning up.
Very clever, because I think when I didn't quite get it first watching the movie, I was thinking, okay, arrival, that's quite blatant. But then I read
there's literally another science fiction movie, I think with Charlie Sheen, called The Arrival. It came out in the 90s or something, called The Arrival. And I've read other short stories called The Arrival, and it's always to do with aliens turning up.
Yes.
And when I heard that this movie was called Arrival, I was like, oh, really? That's such a cliche. There's literally other alien turning up movies and short stories called The Arrival. And then, of course, when you watch it, you're like, oh, no, birth. Ah, okay, that's it.
And also, afterwards reading the short story, that was very obvious to me, because it was kind of mentioned straight away in the first kind of section, where it was about the arrival of the baby.
Yeah.
It was very, it was clearly mentioned several times in the book.
Yeah.
So, in one way, they kind of took very important part of the book and made it into the movie.
Yeah.
And I think if it would have been called The Story of Your Life, it, I mean, I could see this, but then they would go away from the science fiction a bit.
Yeah.
Because it would just be more just fiction and just more of a general telling about life.
Yeah.
Which it is. But I'm yeah, it's good that
it's
they
It's clever
spoil
because
it.
Arrival can be spaceships arriving on Earth, and it also can be the story of someone's life or the start of someone's life. Okay.
Yes, yes.
So that's good.
That's good.
Okay, here's Karine.
And I want to, I don't know what you want to talk about next, but I want to ask, was this podcast inevitable?
This podcast? Well, let's talk the idea of this. Okay, so this is the question that I talked about on other podcasts. The idea being, okay, does the person who has had their brain rewired by the language / by the aliens, whatever's happening there, is this... does she at the end of the movie? Well, let's talk about the book first, okay? At the end of at no point in the book is it ever shown that she has a choice to change anything in her life. It's talked very, very clearly that the aliens, it's like a performative action. They know what's going to happen, but it only becomes true when they do it.
Exactly.
What happens to them in the future only, it's going to happen, and they know it's going to happen, but it only becomes true knowledge if it actually does happen in the future. Now, this is explored. I really like the way this is explored in the movie, in that the things that happen in the future that reflect back... Again, I have storytelling issues with this by combining this with other things, like the idea that does she have a choice or not? For example, General Shang.
Yeah.
Comes to... She doesn't make a decision to say... In the past, I gave you a phone call, which means that now I have to meet with you and ask you what your telephone number is and also what the dying words of your wife were.
Yeah.
She doesn't do that. That happens to her. She doesn't have any choice for that to happen to her in the future. There is a paradox. There is a bootstrap paradox. It's sort of like, going back in time and all the kind of time loops that you have in these stories, where you go, well, that person goes to the future, but then how does it change and how does information flow both ways? What I really liked about the movie is that she doesn't make any choices in the future that she has any control over.
Yes.
She doesn't. It's not there. General Shang comes to her and said, you did this to me. So there is a circular thing. There is an information circle going on there.
There is. But also, there's this one position where they are about to leave in the helicopters. And she's standing there. And you can see her having these memories and kind of making the decision to go back.
Yes. No, the point is, she plays out what she knows must happen.
Yes.
She doesn't make a decision to do it. She does it.
Yeah.
Maybe she is making a decision, but there's no point where she says, shall I do this or not?
No.
She has forward memories, which is a great thing. I really like these little flash forwards. At one point, you see this obelisk kind of thing, this super 2001 kind of thing. And you're like, what's that? And then later on, she goes and gets in it and flies up. And, she sees her, I have memories of stuff floating around my hands. Mm. And you're like, oh, she's in the tank with the aliens and whatever's happening in that white gooey, spermy stuff going on there.
Yeah.
In
silicon something.
Whatever, silica, something, something, silica, something. So that's going on there. And she's having this forward knowledge. These memories are either Sapir-Whorf hypothesis somehow perceiving the future, or memories that she's been given by aliens who know the future and they perceive it. You know, there's different ways to interpret, you know, actually what's going on the screen there, I think. But when she actually asks, do I have a choice to change any of this stuff? The screenwriter seems to think that there is a choice there.
Yes.
And other people who I've heard talk about this on other podcasts seem to think that she's got a choice, and she's making the choice, yes, I'm going to have this baby anyway, even knowing that this baby is going, or this child is going to die when she's 15 years old.
Yes.
And she chooses to go along with it anyway. And then later she chooses to tell Ian, whatever his name is, Hawkeye.
In the movie.
Yeah, in the movie. Yeah, in Ian in the movie. It's different in the book. That's what I'm getting confused about. It is Ian, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ian walks, yeah. So she chooses to do... But there is no point in the movie where we actually see her making that choice.
No.
Even the time when she says... When he says, do you want to have a baby? And she says, yes. And yeah, she's not deciding then if she wants to have... Or shall we make a baby? She is saying... Now we are going to make a baby, and I do want it, but I don't see that there's any choice happening there.
I don't see that. And also, I think, I mean, I can see that people want to put this in there, and they...
Well, the screenwriter says, we're going to say that she has a choice.
Yes.
But even then, I don't see her making any choices. And the whole bootstrap paradox, she isn't deciding to do that. Like I say, Shang comes to her and says, I think it's important now for me to do this. And she's like, what? Like, she doesn't even remember clearly what's going on. And she's like, she's kind of remembering this whole situation. It's been really confusing, but it all crystallizes and going, oh, I need to go here. And when Ian comes in, she says, stand there. This is only going to take one more minute. Do you trust me?
Yeah.
And he stands there for one more minute. Yeah. And then 1 minute later. So she kind of is in control. She knows what's going on there and she acts on it.
But also, I think it's kind of like, if it would be about her having a choice, it would be a totally different movie and you would have to go further into that into that topic.
Yes.
And they didn't. They concentrated on something else.
Yeah, the end of the world, bootstrap paradox, time loop, information thing. And this is the thing which kind of annoys me story-wise and plotting-wise about this, which is, you got to not click your fingers, it's coming in here. In the book, there isn't a thing, there isn't end of the world shit happening in the short story, in Ted Chiang's short story. And there isn't a gift that people, they've got to put together, and there isn't sort of like, oh, is it a tool or a weapon? There's none of that. The only thing that really changes in the book, once the aliens leave, they're like, well, why were they here? No reason. Were they just tourists? We don't know. Were they doing scientific experiments on us? Maybe. And then the only people who get the power, or the only people who have their brains rewired are all of the linguists who learned the things with them.
Yes.
But then nobody else gets that gift. Whereas in the book, in the movie, they're like, oh, we should make it, you know, we should make it that the gift that they're going to give us be this language and being able to see the future.
In the movie, it's actually more perceived as a weapon that she then has.
Yes, and can wield against.
As a gift.
Or a tool. Yeah. Well, it's a tool.
It's a tool.
We're going to give this tool.
It's
now, that changed.
Weapon.
In the movie, when they were writing this, the original versions in the script, the gift that the aliens were going to give the humans was going to be a spaceship arc technology. You know, a bit like Contact, where, like, you do this and you can build this and you go to the star.
Yeah.
But then Interstellar came out and they're like, we can't really just do, you know, aliens from the future. Aliens with future knowledge
helping
are going to come here and give us a wormhole or a spaceship to do this kind of stuff, which I understand. However, in the movie itself, even into the future, it seems like she is still the only person who really understands this gift. And this has to be kind of my headcanon. This is me kind of making excuses for what the movie doesn't do well. Because if all of humanity gets this gift and starts being able to see the future, she wouldn't be the only one who can see her daughter dying. Everybody who knows her who also manages to get this gift. And so I think that she's written a book in the future. She's studied this more and got this understanding in her own brain, because her brain has been rewired by the aliens to do this.
Yeah.
By the language / by the aliens. I think the gift that they're going to have, this gift of this knowledge, is going to take hundreds of many generations for humans to grasp this gift and be able to use it.
3,000 years.
Yeah, like in 3,000 years, we're going to come back and you're going to have something to help us. Which means that I think still at the moment, even at the end of the movie, which is, say, 15 years after the movie begins, you know, after the kid grows up and then dies and all that kind of stuff, she is still the only person who has her brain wired this way. And it's going to take the rest of the world a lot longer to do it. You know, when they have the UN and all the flags of all the countries which have had the aliens visiting them are on the wall. And Shang comes up to her and says, it's an honor, you know, it's an honor for you to be here, because it still feels like she is one of the most special people in the world at that point. She's the only one who really understands and has really got to grips with this. And somehow, even being as one of the most important people in the world, she still lives in the same house for some reason. But fair enough, you know, she still lives in, you know, Quebec or where. No, I mean, that was filmed in Quebec,
yes,
I think.
I don't know where it played. It never said where it played.
Yeah, but it's not Boston. They didn't go to MIT or wherever it was. You know, she was somewhere else, not Boston or whatever it is. Somewhere in New England, I guess.
What I wanted to say about the movie, first of all, I think it was one of the best science fiction movie that I've recently watched, because it takes such of these silent, kind of calm ways to approach science fiction, as it views humanity with all its flaws.
But it's very knowing about that. It's very setting itself. It's like, we are going to now be a meditation on the thoughts and acts of mankind.
We will.
And I've got no problem with that. I really enjoyed that.
Let me speak. They showed very thoroughly how humanity is more about destruction and going against each other than they are for let's unite and let's just go forward together against this unknowing thing.
Yeah.
What I didn't like, and really, really, really didn't like, was what was going on in the rest of the world, where suddenly riots happened, and I didn't understand why. The thing is, if something like this happens and there's nothing coming out of it, there's nothing, they're not shooting at us, they're not doing anything, I think life would just go on as normal.
Yeah,
it is. Nobody at some point, and it's like with all news stories, okay, there were aliens, they don't do anything. It doesn't actually affect my life, so I can just live on normal.
In a way, I kind of understand it with sort of like, the rest of the world is in chaos. Oh, but here in America, the military is under control. And I'm like, I don't really see any of those checkpoints, and it's not really that much, you know, like, I didn't understand how, like, what was that barrier keeping people back from the spaceship, you know, in that thing in Montana? There was like this road coming down. You're like, oh, this looks really much like, you know, every science fiction movie where there's a thing going across. But just think of that, how far that perimeter was from that spaceship. How big was that perimeter? How quickly could even the US Army secure a perimeter that wide in the middle of Montana?
Yeah.
Some of it didn't make sense.
Also,
but
if there's such a huge mass of people there, they can do whatever they want. If the mass wants to get in, they do get in.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of...
It did feel a bit unrealistic. And also, one thing I made a note of, which I really didn't... There's two things about this movie which I thought were kind of lazy movie making. One was all the news reports, literally just saying, here is a news report. Now we are going to have a news report. Now, news reports. And it all looked really fake. You know, they weren't the real CNN, you know, because in other movies you get real news anchors in to do it, you know. Or real news program, you get the B. It's often CNN does it, you know. It's like CNN. But the point is, it makes the movie feel really dated. It makes the movie feel like something from the 90s, that all of the news exposition and info dumping is by talking heads and news footage. There's nothing about, you know, nothing what Twitter says, nothing, but, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I understand it that can be suddenly more complicated, but you still got the Alex Jones kind of conspiracy theory InfoWars section, you know, the TV,
well,
the
you
internet
had YouTube
TV.
In it.
Yeah. But yeah, so YouTube, there was the live stream of the person. Hey, these people are idiots. Call in, tell us what you think, you know, that kind of stuff. But it never really felt like, I don't know, it just felt really lazy. They could have shown what was happening in the rest of the world in a more artful way, considering so much of the rest of the movie is done really well. I mean, there is a lot of info dumping in other ways, and people literally just drawing stuff on whiteboards. Okay, let me explain. We need this, this, and this. And so much of the other stuff was done in a fun character way. But all the rest of the stuff happening around the world was so much sort of like, and now this person is going to sit and watch a television and we're going to be told stuff, but then they don't really, it's not really their story, but we're going to get it because, well, someone has to be watching the story, yeah. You know, at that point. And then at the end, the resolution where you get that kind of black screen and then one news report and it all fades in. I was like, ugh. The other movie-making thing that I didn't like, which was actually explained in this little art of scriptwriting, or scriptwriter, I can't remember the little title that we watched. It's like, hi, my name's Michael, and welcome to Script to Movie, or whatever it was called, this YouTube
screenplay thing.
Screenplay to movie, yeah. And they even said, oh, actually, we're going to have all of this exposition thing, but it took too long, so now we're just going to have a montage in the middle. When I first watched that montage, the first time I watched the movie, I was like, what the hell is a montage voiceover doing? And it skipped over stuff which I thought was so important. And like 80% of the book, which is, oh, we're now going to explore this. Why is the language? Why are these logographs in a circle? Why is it like this? And all of that stuff, which was like 70% of the scientific... I mean, of course, the book also has the flashbacks and flashbacks to the childhood. But the rest of it is coming to grips with what the language is and why they write that way. And there was a bit of that in the movie, but then... most of the actual sciencey, linguisty stuff in the story was compressed down into this voiceover, and it wasn't even a voice. Who was doing the voiceover? Jeremy Renner. Ian.
It felt kind of quite sudden. Suddenly, it was a different kind of movie format, and also. I mean, I didn't see that lots of the science was left out in the movie because I didn't know.
But the point is, but it's not even like, I don't mind that they're not going to do the full science exploration as what they do in the book. You know, like, even in the book, there's literally diagrams in the short story, like saying here is a path of light that comes this way and it just goes this way. Why does it go there? I mean, they didn't
even touch this.
No, and all of the
there was. I was thinking sometime. Why was he there? What was his job? We saw a fully scribbled whiteboard with mathematical and physical equations. I saw that, but it had never anything to do with what actually happened in front of the aliens.
Yeah.
You know, we always saw the linguistic point of view, and I think it is valid in a story like this to separate out the two scientific big points and just concentrate on one. Which was hers, because it was her story. But also, I think it was kind of a pity, because I saw reading the book then, the story, how much more there was about mathematics and physics and all this.
It felt like more of a partnership between the science and the language.
Yes.
Like at the start of the movie, she says, language is the basis of civilization. He says, oh, science. And Forrest Whitaker says, well, that's the reason why you're both here.
Yes.
And in the story, it feels like, there's a reason why they're both there. And in, like I say, now I know that the end of the movie, the gift that we were going to give was scientific breakthrough. It would feel like at the end of the movie, she gets one gift, which is the language, and he gets a different gift, the scientists get also a gift about what the science is.
In the story?
No, in the movie. I said, the original screenplay, like I say, had them giving a spaceship to them at the end, or spaceship technology, you know. Yeah. That's what it was going to be. And then they were like, it's a bit too much like Interstellar, whatever. Yeah. Let's just have the gift be the language, which means that Ian, the physicist, doesn't get a gift at the end, because even then the main gift of the aliens is her gift. So in the end, she doesn't get anything.
No. He gets a gift.
What's that?
You really don't see this. He gets the child because...
Yeah,
because...
No.
In this kind of thinking, this would be the gift he would get.
Yeah. What I'm saying is, in the movie, it seems to be setting up that there is science on one side and there is language on the other side. And then halfway through the movie, when Ian is going to... He suddenly starts doing a voiceover. You're like...
Was that him?
Yes, it was. No. Yes, it was. Who was doing the voiceover?
It was a totally different voice.
No, it's him saying, oh, and then we discovered this. She put us all... Oh. He's saying, she put us all... It's him. It's Ian who's doing the voiceover.
Do you know? How do you know?
It's him. It's his voice. It's Hawkeye. It's okay. Fucking... It's right. Jeremy Renner. It was him doing... Because he was saying... And then Louise Banks, she put us all to shame. And it's in the voiceover. He is voicing over him looking at her, putting them all to shame. Like doing lots of scribbling on the diagrams and stuff like that.
Okay, I thought it was a...
But the point, and that's my point, is that at that point you would think, oh, and then we discovered this about science and discovered that about science. And they look at science this way and that way. But no, even by the end of the movie... His whole role in the movie, like you say, what is his? In the end, he becomes the love interest, which is fine. I've got no problem with that. But it does feel like he, like in the first version of the script, at the end, she was going to get the language brain changing in her, yeah. The Sapir-Whorf rewiring of the brain, and he was going to be the one who went, "Oh, I've worked it out. It's a spaceship." You know, but we need to put all 12 parts of this spaceship together and then we can create the drive technology or whatever it's going to, you know, whatever it's going to be that the aliens gave them to make wormholes or space technology or floating spaceship. But at that point, he's just like, oh, I've worked it out. It's in 12 pieces. We just need to put it all together. And then what do we get when we put it all together? Well, you've already worked out in your brain.
But I also see this making a lot of sense having this in the screenplay because some of it was left in the movie. He was, like, I think 3 times or something, asking about faster-than-light travel.
Yeah.
And it never got revealed.
Yeah.
It just, like, it was kind of like, okay, his role was just supporting her in the end.
Yeah.
And which is fine, which is... I mean,
but now I know because reading Wikipedia, it said, "Oh, the thing that they were going to get in the end was spaceship technology."
Yeah.
But they took that out of the movie, and in the end, what they got was what she got anyway.
Yes, which is different to the story itself.
Well, in the story, they didn't get anything.
Yeah.
I'm saying.
They didn't get anything special scientifically.
Yeah.
She still got out what she got out of it, but.
And watching the movie the second time. I hadn't actually read the Wikipedia page about that, what they changed about that, but watching the movie the second time, it hit me even more that the scientist is doing the voiceover about the language stuff, but earlier on she was doing voiceover. So she was doing voiceover at the start about, I used to think this is where your story begins, but actually now... So, like, she was doing voiceover at one point, and then he was doing voiceover again, but he was doing a voiceover stuff in the middle, but not even about his own topic.
Yes.
You know, like, at the start, he's like, here's your team, the science team over here, and here's your team, the linguist team over here. And I actually really like that moment when they both come in
and then
you're in charge, and she's like, what am I doing here?
When I saw this first, I thought, okay, this is now the typical kind of behavior in these movies. Okay, the man and the woman scientists walk in, and then the man gets introduced to the people, and the woman just has
ignored.
A plane. But it was more clever than that. I really like that because then she came into the room and everyone came and shook hands with her because everyone knew her.
Coming over to her, like, oh, a pleasure to work with you.
So,
like, none of the physicists knew who she was. They were like, oh, fuck, Jeremy Renner's here.
Did they know that he
The point is, when he turns up, they're like, hey, this is your team, everyone's in charge, and everyone looks at him and just goes, oh yeah, this guy, we know this guy.
Yeah.
And then the same thing happens to her, all the linguists are like going,
like,
oh, I've read your book.
Yeah, that's great. So I think in this kind of respect, this movie does a really, really good showing of like, she's not even a strong woman. She's just a woman with lots of scientific knowledge in her field of expertise.
Yeah.
And that I kind of like that because she's just a normal person.
Mm.
She's just an extraordinary person in her expertise. But otherwise, she's just a normal person. She's not anything...
Yeah. What I also like about Jeremy Renner being the love interest is, or, you know, his role as well. He's not a Superman either. I really like that when he jumps from the platform, he just, like, falls over and clumps down the floor and goes, oh, fuck. Would, like, you know, he can't live, like, in a normal, as you say, in a normal movie, he'd be, like, the hero. He'd jump across and later would save her. He doesn't do, I mean, he does a bit of saving later on, but it's more like he just needed to be there in that moment and her to say, do you trust me? And he's like, yes, but he's not, like, saving the day or anything at that point.
No, but, but I really like that in this movie. Also, just a short intersection. I recently also watched Independence Day, the second movie, the part 2.
Oh, did you? Oh, yeah, I remember you saying.
And,
I've not seen it.
And this is, like, so the opposite to this. So the opposite.
Like, the white American man is the hero.
And macho, and, like, you get all the things, and... Yeah, it is different. It is totally different, and I have different kind of things to say about this. This is for another time. But I really, really enjoyed the silent tones in this movie.
What,
not speaking about the music.
Yeah.
But the silent kind of...
Just the moments, yeah.
Just the moments and the way that the pictures were speaking for itself.
Yeah, very good movie making. There are a few more things about which I think is interesting. In the aliens, in the book, the aliens have rotational symmetry, but their writing isn't circular. I mean, you can look at it in any direction and then write it in any way up. And even in the movie, I think there might have been a change of the design of the aliens or something from, you know, when they were filming it, they kind of had some concept drawings of what the aliens would look like. And he even says, the aliens don't have a sense of forward and backwards. They look all directions equally.
Yes.
And that means their writing is all dimensions, is all directions equally. It's a circle, you know, and it can go any way up. He says that as we're watching two aliens walking forwards, like they actually do, like the way that they have heptapods there, they actually have five legs on the front and two in the back, not seven legs all the way around. So I just thought that was a fun design decision.
Yeah, they always look to me like if you have a hand.
Yeah, with like two thumbs out
down,
the back. Yeah.
And then that always looked like a massive big hand to me.
Yeah.
With tentacles in the butt.
Is fine, but there was
definitely... Also, the eyes were missing.
Yeah, there was definitely a front and back to these aliens. But even in the script, Jeremy Renner is saying they don't have forward and backwards, they're rotationally symmetry, and their writing is circles. Which, to be honest, I actually quite like the idea of writing being circles more than... it's easier to picture in the movie. I understand why they did circular logograms.
Wasn't the guy Heisner? Jeremy Heisner?
Jeremy Renner?
Who's that?
Jeremy Renner is Hawkeye.
Oh, okay.
Is Ian.
Okay. Ian. Okay.
There's pretty much only two characters in this movie, everyone else is just there to kind of... whatever. So, the other thing that I quite like is how old do the heptapods live? Go.
I don't know. They never said it.
Yeah. But on some other podcasts that I heard, they're like, oh, yeah, they live like thousands of years, and that's how they know what's going to happen in thousands of years' time. However, if you've read the story, the first 15 lives of Harry August, we understand that people who know the future can tell what they know the future when they're very young. They can tell that to old people. And then when those old people are very young, they can tell that to very old people. In other words, you can pass information back down generations. And it's explored really well in the first 15 lives of Harry August. I'm just saying that there is a way that the heptapods can only live 100 years each. But if they can all see the future when they're younger, they just need to tell old people what they find out about when they're old.
Right.
And then those old people need to find that tell when they're younger, they need to... It's a weird way. Instead of like passing information down generations, old people tell young people stuff. It's actually young people telling old people stuff, and information can flow backwards from the future 3,000 years from now. So
Even thought about this.
It could be a really hazy memory stuff, but anyway, it's that. It's just something I like. Mm-hmm. So, which brings... Oh, another thing what I like about the production design... And most of the production design are really like the shapes of the spaceships. The inside of the spaceships is really great.
Beautiful.
But what I didn't understand was that they have this iPad and they go, oh, we need this word, this word, this word, this word. And then it all puts it together and then they're like, shall we display it? They even have a say, shall we display it? And they're like, yes, and they display it. However, all of that working out, which they've done on their iPad, has been mirrored in the screen that the aliens can see. Which I think is really funny, that they actually show the logogram being worked out by the computer on a screen in plain view of the aliens, and then they say show, and all that happens is the human user interface around the edge of the logogram just fades away, and it gets slightly bigger, it gets like 10% bigger to fill the screen, and then they're like, there you go. It's like, you can't say, shall we reveal it? It's on TV, the aliens can see, they're just watching. Anyway, so that's that was just one funny thing that I made.
Yes, that was. Also, the bird. Let's talk about the bird.
Oh, the
what
cheapy
is,
bird.
Cheap. What is, I mean, cheap. Yeah.
Canary in the coal mine.
There must be a different meaning to, I mean, I did get the bird that it was, okay, you put the bird there to see if it is a living environment and if there's deadly gases. The bird dies before. And, but also in the movie, it was shown when the daughter draws a picture of Louise and Ian and her
it's two of them
people
talking to animals and they show the bird
and the bird
yeah
and so obviously there was some deeper meaning or more meaning to the bird than just like, here's a living creature, let's just put it there.
I just think, I really liked that when, and again, we just watched this little movie. I said, what I really like is the dream sequence, because the dream sequence doesn't feel like it's written like normal dream sequences in the movie. And it turns out it wasn't written as a dream sequence. But they cut together footage from another scene that they had and then put in some special effects, and they changed the color grading so everything was a bit more orange. And then when it's not dream sequence anymore, it turns blue. But they also put the bird sound effect into the dream. Did you notice that as well?
Yeah.
That she's like, do you ever dream in Heptapod B? And she's like, choo, choo, choo. Yeah. And you're like, oh, this is a dream.
On the other hand, I thought sometimes this cheeping was also in the music.
Yeah, well, that's the point, is that that just becomes part of her experience, I think, you know, and it does become part of the story. I'm not sure if there's much more, it's just symbolism. It's sort of like the bird is there, and if the bird dies, it means you might die. And the daughter showing a picture of the bird, the daughter doesn't understand that that's a symbol of when the bird dies, you die. Like the bird, you know, the bird is a symbol of mortality. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
So, sure, there's meaning to it. I don't think there's any deeper meaning except the bird is a symbol of mortality.
Yeah.
But I do like the mummy and daddy talking to animals, and then there's like later on there's like the Plasticine Heptapod and among other animals. You're like, that was pretty cool.
The costume design.
Yeah.
I really thought was, it was quite blatant.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I thought it was quite visual,
yeah.
Especially, you know, when they climb into this chimney and then they float around and then they walk in it. And then you have this dark grey, rough, rippled ground everywhere. And then these orange whatever. And it's so funny because, yes, of course, if you are, what is the first encounter with a human? The human would be an orange blob.
I think the aliens know what humans look like.
Yeah, but it is quite funny to have humans walk in orange big things. They're kind of like putting themselves into weird... You know, like in Independence Day, how they have
the aliens have the exosuit.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is not how they look like because they are in a suit. And this is how humans now are.
One thing that I was actually laughing about when I saw when we looked up, does the video shop have the Blu-ray? Yes, it does. And the front cover of the Blu-ray on the website is really funny because they're two beautiful people, Jeremy Renner looking like amazing with fantastic hair and hair with like in front of this spaceship, and she's got swoop like... There's this beautiful hair and beautiful makeup. And actually, the entire time that they're there in the movie, there's like snot running down their faces. Their hair is just sort of like all over the place.
Yeah.
They look like they've been working around the clock for, 50 weeks however many days it is.
And this is what I find beautiful as well, when they have the sequence of her being in the thing where she's getting into this little elevator kind of thing.
Yeah, and her hair just breaks free and goes like that.
And then her face is like beautiful and everything is white.
To be honest, the hair special effects, not perfect.
That's great, but it was
impressive
enough.
What they're going there.
It was impressive enough. And I think it was definitely a good way to go. Was there anything else?
Anything else? We've gone 51 minutes. I said the entire reason why I wanted to do this is because there's everybody else who have heard talking about the story and this and the movie hasn't touched on something which I thought was the most important thing about the entire story and then was different in the movie, and nobody else has talked about it.
Okay.
This is really important for me that I want to talk about. Should we finally get to it?
You
51
have not
minutes?
Talked about
no,
it.
No, I haven't talked about it. Should we do it?
Go for it.
Okay, here is the thing. In the short story, there is no transfer, there is no noticeable, there is no story-based transfer of information through time. Like, from the future back into the past. There is a very clear moment of information remembering something in the future from the past where, you know, and it's even in the movie, the line, what do you call this thing where both people get something? Compromise. No, it's something else. Like, they both get what they want out and actually more. A win-win situation. No, more science-y. And in the end, it comes down to, and then you get a flashback and he says, oh, it's a zero-sum game. You know, no, a non-zero-sum game. That's it.
Yes.
So we both play something and we both get together more out of it than both of us put in combined.
Yes.
So you put in 5, I put in 5, and we both get out 7 each. Whatever you want to say. And it's a great thing. Non-zero-sum game. And I like that idea. But that's the only thing that travels forward through time. Or, you know, that's just what happens. She just remembers it.
Yes.
It's just a memory. And we get a flash forward, but in the movie and in the book, well, mostly in the movie, we get a flash back, but it's actually a flash forward of her remembering something from the time.
Yeah.
But there's no useful transfer I'm talking about the short story. There's no useful transfer of information from the future to the past. Okay.
No.
So, not even with the alien saying in 3,000 years time. No, not even that. It's purely about the perception. And she's saying that me and this other person, we were just playing out a play, both knowing that we don't have any choice about what happens. Okay, so my first reading of the book, when I read this back in 2012, my reading of the book was, there is no seeing of the future. What I understood this to be is that her brain has been rewired so that at any point when she is thinking, she doesn't remember what her brain processes were like and what she remembered at the time that she was experiencing something. So for me, this was all a function of memory and what you remember when. Okay, so she says, I'm writing this story, or I'm telling this story on the day of your conception, or the day of your birth, or before you're born, and now I remember this into the future. The way that I finish reading the book is that she says, I have 50 years worth of memories in my brain of this kind up until the time that she was born. I read the book in a way that she was actually on her deathbed, or after her daughter had died. So it's actually after her daughter has died as she is telling this story.
Yes.
Of the daughters like that. But her brain has been rewired in a way that she can't tell. She doesn't understand where she is in time. She thinks she is telling the story from the point of view of the day of the conception, and she thinks that she is now looking forward in time and remembering things into the future. But actually, and this is the way that I read the book, actually what she is what is happening is her brain has come unstuck in time. It even says in the short story that whole chunks of memory arrive in my brain fully formed. Like, I experience entire chunks of memory fully formed. And this is my reading, that it isn't somebody who is there. In their own mind and in their own memories, they are now seeing things all the way through time, but they themselves don't know, or they don't remember what they knew at the time, because they, thinking back to what they knew at the time, they can't have any conception of not knowing what they already know now. And that happens to both people, and they say, we are just now, at that point, we both looked at each other, and stuff was happening, but because two people, even at the time, they knew that they wouldn't be able to remember what is forward and backward, so they kind of, it's kind of a freeing from free will, by freeing their mind from knowing what time they knew something at.
Yeah.
All this to say that I read this book again after watching the movie and how they changed it in the movie. Here, it's in the short story, it still feels very clear to me that the only time that she remembers knowing something in the past that she thinks that she's acted on is her having a dream about her daughter dying in the future. And she even says that that probably affected me in some way. Because I had that dream, it's not that I always knew that you were going to die of a rock climbing accident. It's that I had a dream about that once. And in that case, I kept on asking, I tried to keep you safe from all of that stuff, and probably in the end pushed you into the situation. But in that dream, she didn't dream that her daughter had died. She had a dream that she herself had died. So the knowledge that the dream
in the story,
in the short story, she doesn't dream that her daughter dies of a rock climbing accident.
She dreams that her daughter climbs out of her backpack thing and
yes,
then falls
and
down.
Falls down. But she doesn't have a dream that a 25-year-old daughter dies of a. So even that, even the only time in the book where she thinks she has foreknowledge of something, she doesn't even have foreknowledge of the thing that her daughter even dies of. But because her brain is unstuck in time and memory, she doesn't even have a conception of when she had that dream, even before her daughter was conceived, that that wasn't something to do with her. Because she is now, after the death of her daughter, her brain can't understand what she knew at any point in the past. it is very much a Billy Pilgrim becoming unstuck in time. And Billy Pilgrim, in the book Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut, doesn't understand what is fantasy or what is not fantasy. And he doesn't... he's just going like, oh, I've had this massively traumatic experience and my brain is concocting this fantasy world. And so now I think that I know what's going to happen in the future. And there's obviously stuff which is complete fantasy where he goes to different planets and has sex with space princesses and stuff like that.
I might want to read it.
Yes, but I'm just saying there's stuff which is obviously fantasy and there's other stuff which isn't fantasy, but it's told from a point of view who doesn't, when he was having the experiences, he now doesn't remember what he knew at the time. Like his brain has come unfixed in time. And this is what I see in when I was reading the book. Because there is no transfer of knowledge from the future to the past. There is only people who get their brains rewired by the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis or whatever's going to happen by learning this language. The only way that they conceive of their memories is all of their memories at once. The only way that they can look back at their life is to not know what happened when or what they knew throughout life. They just see the final result.
Yeah.
They don't see... it's sort of like, I don't understand how the light beam knows where my eye is to be take the shortest path to my eye.
The quickest.
You know, not the shortest path. Yeah, that's specific. It's not the shortest path. It's the quickest path to my eye because it has to always... travel, always has to do something at the fastest possible rate.
And it has to know that before it goes onto it.
But the point is that light beam doesn't know all the way that, because that light, there's actually light beams going in all different directions, and the only way they could do it is if you had a laser and shine it. But then if the laser wasn't shining exactly the right place, the human eye wouldn't see it except for maybe some diffraction in the water or something like that. The eye is picking out a light beam which has already made that journey and saying, well, how did it know all the time? And that's what we have in the book, is that we have someone who has already lived all that line and saying, well, how did I know all the future that whole time? But the person, the two linguists that we have in the book who think they know that, they're just... both, she is just remembering back to a moment where she had already accepted that she can't control the future and she's going to have entire chunks of memory all plopping down into her brain. This is how I read the book in the first way. Unfortunately, maybe my reading, which I presume was the correct reading, in that it was a story about freeing your mind from not even knowing what order to come in, but accepting that you don't have control. Like, nothing that happened in your life is because you decided one way or the other. Like, you don't have free will, which I think is very liberating, and I think that's what the movie and the story is about. It's about accepting what happens into the future.
Also... yeah. It is not only that what you understood, it actually says it. It
in
says it in words. It says, if you have a free will, it's impossible to know the future. And if you know the future, it is impossible to have a free will. It actually says it.
Yeah.
It's just like how I remember it.
Yeah.
But I didn't actually take it out.
Yeah, it was a PDF. We couldn't just make bookmarks.
But yes, it actually says it. If you have a free will, you don't see the future.
Yeah.
And if you do see the future, you just don't have a free will anymore.
Yeah, but my point is that they can't even see the future. What they're doing is they're looking at the past and thinking that they could see the future. But the point is their brain has been rewired to tell them that they don't have free will.
Yes.
And so by accepting that they don't have free will, it's like they imagine that they've seen everything into the future, but they haven't. They're just remembering as though they have no free will. So if in the future you look back at your life and think, I had no free will throughout this entire period, you don't then have to look, oh, I made this decision and then that happened, and then I made this decision and that happened, and this happened and that happened. You know, the causality as the book is talking about, the story is talking about. If you look back and say, free will doesn't exist and it's purely deterministic, it doesn't matter what you knew at any moment. You can just see the course of action at any moment.
Yeah.
Knowledge and deciding and knowing all that stuff is out the window. So I do believe that in my reading of the story, is that they don't know what's going to happen in the future. But once they have lived it and do know what's going to happen in the future, looking back, that's fully formed in their mind throughout every point. It's weird to look at it that way, but that was my reading of the book. And that reading of the book doesn't make sense in the movie because information is passed backward in time. You know, the whole, you know, General Shang time loopy stuff.
Yeah.
If that General Shang time loopy stuff wasn't in there, it would feel like somebody is just giving up free will and is just moving through life and accepting life. And that's, weirdly enough, when I watched the movie, I really didn't like the General Shang bootstrap paradox time loop, because I think it detracts from the acceptance of life and death and love and breaking up with people that is going to happen to everyone. Well, not everyone, you know, but, you know, if you actually look at how many relationships people have in their life, statistically, not all of them last until they die. You know,
yeah.
Anyone who's had more than one relationship in their life statistically hasn't loved only one person, and, you know, until death do us part. Like, I'm just saying, when you look at it that way, you know.
Yeah.
But like, when I say relationships, you know, like, you get together and you're like, this person's the one. Oh, no, this person's the one. Like, I've had a few this person's the one in my life, you know.
I didn't.
No, just one.
Just one?
Yeah, just one. Exactly. But my point being that if now I look back at my previous life before you and me got together, I can concoct a story of from all of my failed relationships in the past to construct a narrative about how all of them led to you and me getting together. You know?
Yeah.
I can do that. But there's no free will there, because all of those, I never made those decisions along the way, but now looking back, I can see that story. So I could look back and say, oh, this relationship that I had when I was 16, or when with this person,
so
I learned this thing.
You're saying, looking backwards, in the situation where I'm now,
yeah,
every decision led to this, to
yes,
this now. And you didn't really, the decisions you did made,
yeah,
all came to this point.
The point is that I can look at my life and say, oh, I made this decision, it led to that. But it's all bullshit. I never made any of those decisions. Like, I didn't have a decision to have, like, a really, really painful, hurtful breakup when I was 23 years old, and then get into, you know, and then to do all other stuff, and then to have a relationship with Pola. Long-term listeners of the podcast, or people who listen to the early episodes, will know that, you know, I lived with someone, my previous German girlfriend, you know, all this other kind of stuff, and the things that I learnt from that relationship, which make our relationship a lot better. But there is no story there. I'm concocting the story now and putting it backwards through. But imagine that if at the time, like, imagine now if my brain has been rewired that I don't understand all of those things, so I could be thinking, oh, it's really important for me to do this now, because then in 4 years time, when I get together with Juliana, I'm going to make this decision, and then we're going to do this together. But that only makes sense looking back from my vantage point now, and doesn't make sense to my brain. But if my brain had been rewired in an alien way, it could have been that way.
Yeah. I'm not entirely following you with all this kind of stuff.
But now I understand that. I guess now I understand why my reading of this short story is probably incorrect. Because this made so much sense to me when I was reading the short story. That's like, yeah, it's all in here. There is no free will. But because they think they know the future, they have to admit to each other. The linguists who look at each other and go, yeah, oh, we're just playing something out. We're not deciding what to do now. At the time, they were thinking, oh, yeah, we're not deciding what to do now. But it's only past where they can look back and say, oh, yes, we were doing this because this had to happen, and then this would happen later. But it's only in the past that you... No, so it's only when you get to the future that you can look back into the past and have that in your brain. It's not actually in your brain at the time. But if you release your brain from the idea of free will, you open up the option of reinterpreting everything that's happened in the past as just something that's happened, not something that's happened for a reason, you know. Maybe the aliens' brains are different, but I don't know. That's the thing. Like, the aliens, in the end, never gave the humans anything that the humans didn't already know.
No.
They never gave the humans any advanced technology in the book. There was nothing there. There wasn't anything there.
Mm-mm.
Even in the end, they said, oh, we're really disappointed. There was some, you know, some material science that we thought, oh, this is a breakthrough. Turns out this lab here had already done it.
Japan, so even
the aliens weren't giving them future technology saying anything about the future.
But, I mean, this is the thing that I quite like. It is quite placative. Placative? You say
what
that? It's quite...
What does that mean?
It's quite open. Open and like right there on the nose. Kind of, you know, when the only thing the aliens do... And this is...
Is this in the story?
No,
or
it's in general. It's in general in lots of... science fiction is just about that.
Okay.
What it shows is it kind of puts a looking glass on humanity.
Yeah.
And I think in this one especially, it shows how humans just because of their individuality,
yeah,
and because of their individual perception of me and you and past and future,
yeah,
it's the way that humans work, right?
Yeah.
And what the book does, or more what the movie does in here, is that they that it shows you need to work together as a human being race to. That is the gift they get.
Yeah,
you work in the movie. Together.
Yeah, in the end. But that happens so often in this science fiction. So
I know. Like, and I know. This is what I'm saying.
And
it's
the real gift
the
was within us all along. It was just give peace a chance. Yeah.
Yes, and this is why I mean, this is why I do like science fiction, and I think every person on Earth should read more science fiction to get this understanding that humans are just stupid, fighting wars against each other and all this kind of shit.
But it seems to be a very basic level if you just look at science fiction like that. That's my point is that I looked at this because I read this story before watching the movie. I mean, even though, like I say, it's obviously stuck with me pretty well because I remembered it, or I remembered all of the stuff that I liked about it from 2012 to 2017. So 5 years later, the story was still fresh enough in my mind that it was how I was viewing the movie through the lens of how I thought I understood the short story, which is probably wrong.
I'm not saying that is all I get out of the movie.
My final thing, though, which is kind of important, is that in the movie, it says Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. She gets this by rewiring, like, the language rewiring the brain. And I can't see any way that she can, like, in the book, she doesn't get any knowledge from the future that she can use. There's no bootstrap paradox of, like, time loopy paradoxes.
Yeah.
Whereas in the movie, there is. And I understand why, because it's a proper demonstration of what the movie makers thought the short story was about. And maybe even Ted Chiang thought the story was about. But I think there's a reason why he didn't put any time loop paradoxes. He even says, it's impossible. Like, nobody has ever changed. We just go along with it. Like, none of us even, now our brains understand this, none of us even make an attempt to change the future because we know there's no point. Whereas in the movie, she does use something from the future to change the future. However, what I thought was, I can't see the only time that the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis now in the final, forgetting about the screenplay, but in the final version of the movie, the only time that that was ever in her brain, or she was ever discussed in the movie, that the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis was rewiring her brain, was in a dream sequence. And asking, do you think this is because you're dreaming in this language?
Yeah.
And the way that I now read the movie is that the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is only there as kind of a way that she can understand what's changing in her brain. But in the end, I think she has been chosen within my final reading of the final version of it, is that her brain has been changed by the aliens in more than just being able to understand the language. I think that that's how she is kind of discussing in her own brain what is going on. It's like, no, now I understand how the language, how the aliens interpret their language, but it could be the reverse is true, you know. I think it's in the end becomes a red herring. I think her brain is reprogrammed, or she is given knowledge, or is given memories of the future by the aliens who can see the future. But she's the only one, like I say, because at the end of the movie, even 15 years later, nobody and her, you know, her husband and all the people at the UN still can't see the future. So I think there's more technology that's going to be there, and the language is going to unlock that technology or unlock that brain stuff. But I think the power of her seeing the future probably comes more from rewiring of the brain or insertion of memories more than just the language itself rewiring the brain and being able to see this, because that's not how it works. Because in the end, in the book, it's totally about her perception, where in the movie, it's literally about knowledge from the future.
Yes.
It's literally about information passing backwards through time, whereas in the book, I think it's much more about her perception of what she's thinking about in any one moment, and she doesn't know if she's in this moment thinking forward or this moment thinking backwards.
I think what the story also makes a lot clearer than the movie does, it actually says it, the way that the language of the aliens is this performative thing, where there is this section where her daughter, where she reads out the story of Goldilocks and the
three bears.
Yes, yeah. And so she reads it out and changes things slightly. She's talking about the balls include spinach and
Brussels sprouts.
Brussels sprouts. Yeah. Because the daughter doesn't like it, and the daughter knows this is not how the story goes, and says, yeah. And says to Louise at that point, tell me the real story. And she says, you know the real story. Why should I tell you? Because
that's the way I like it. She says,
I want to know. And so I think this is the same. This is an analogy to what the. The way that the alien language works.
Yeah.
You do get it all in advance.
Yeah.
But you still have to do it.
Yeah.
For it to be done.
There is no way for her to have known how to read all the alien writing in the past without her also have doing all the study in the future that she already knows that she's going to do and written a book about it. The only way that she knows in the past how she can do this is because she's already written a book about it in the future.
Yes.
If she never read that book about it, she wouldn't have known it.
This is why in my perception, there is no question about a will or a choice. There is just no choice.
But also, my point being is that at that moment, that's another bootstrap paradox. It's sort of like, oh, how can I understand this writing? Oh, in the future, I've written a book about it. And she's thinking, so in the future, I will know it. But I think she...
And this is why I now know it.
Yeah, and that's why I now know it. Yeah. But I also think she will know it and now know it. It means she still has to go through the learning process. Does she? Or was it just implanted in her brain
by alien
memories?
And this kind of next step kind of leads me to where I was... When we were watching the movie, I was constantly saying to Luke, oh, this is like Solaris. This is like this. This is like that.
Yeah.
Because this includes so many ideas, like the influence and the hypnosis kind of abilities of an artifact.
We
just read Blindsight, and you said, oh, this is also Blindsight.
No, because you were saying in the book, it said, what is it when there's an illusion, you can see both sides of the illusion? What did we see that in? We just saw that in a movie, and I was like, Blindsight. It's literally a whole point in the movie, the square, there's a cube, which you can see both
and
sides of the...
Probably, there
you
was
can see
probably,
it both ways
yeah,
at the same
I
time.
I think there was a picture of this in... No, there wasn't. I'm pretty sure we recently watched a movie, like a thing on YouTube,
just saying,
where they showed two things.
I'm just saying, literally in Blindsight, they can say, we can see the vase and the two faces looking at each other. We can only see one or the
time.
Other. And the vampires can see both at the same time.
Yes.
There's a cube. Sometimes the back face is in front and sometimes the front face is in the back or whatever. And they can
maybe
see them both at the same time.
There was a picture of it in the book.
Yeah.
But I vividly remember trying really hard.
It's in the e-book.
I tried really hard to look at this cube from all angles at the same time, and then realizing it really isn't possible for us.
Yeah.
And this is what this book, the story is about as well.
Yeah.
She gets the gift to see it from all dimensions at the same time.
Yeah.
And this is what I think is what it is about. And,
Nick, she can only see all dimensions at the same time if it's already happened.
Exactly.
But she doesn't know which side of the illusion she's on.
Yeah.
She thinks she's looking from the present into the future. Well, actually, she's in the future looking to the past. But because she can see it all at once, it doesn't matter where her perception can be at any moment in that time. But only after it's already happened. That was my reading of the short story.
Yeah.
Is that after everything has happened, her perception of where she is in the story can either be in the past or all the way through to the future. But it can only be up to a point where her brain... It even says, it was only since I learnt the language up until my death, a period of about 50 years, whatever they said, 25 of them were you were alive in. But all that time, I can now see all in the span.
Yeah.
I read that being, she is late in life, she knows she's going to die soon. She does, like, now her perception can range freely over all the time that her brain has been rewired in this way.
Yeah.
And at any point, she thinks she's having memories of the future. But it can only make sense that she can think that she has memories of the future if she also acknowledges that free will doesn't exist and she can't change anything into the future. Because otherwise, your brain wouldn't be able to locate itself in a past area unless... it could also accept that it can't change the future. Because as soon as it might think it could do that, it wouldn't be possible to locate your perception in a past area of your life and think you knew the future if you also think you could use that to change the future.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the clearest way of saying my understanding of it. And I think the book really does clearly show that at no point does any information flow backwards in time.
Yeah.
Even the dream sequence, she isn't remembering, but later, after her daughter has died, of a climbing accident, she remembers the dream of her unborn child falling out of a basket and dying. And I tell you something, I would remember that, because that seems like quite a traumatic dream of having your baby falling out of the back of a thing. Okay, yeah. Someone's at the door. Are we expecting a package?
No, I don't know.
Okay, you get that, and I'll wrap up the end of the podcast, because I've said everything. Is there anything else you want to say? I don't think... All right, then. So, I gave this on my... SFBRP rating for the short story, I gave it like 3 stars, and Juliana was like, why 3 stars? But I think that's all it is, because I didn't have that.
Disappeared.
Doesn't go. Okay, so yeah, I gave this short story 3 stars, but it's because it's only a short story, and I never find short stories satisfying enough as a novel. I mean, if it was novel length, I might have got more out of it, or if there was more story there, except aliens turn up and then they leave for no reason or anything like that.
I think the genius thing about Ted Chiang's short stories, that is, it is like you get the concentrate of a thing.
Yeah.
And I think it can be done in a very weird way. It feels like you're just peeking in and then peeking out and think like, oh, the author could have done a bit better job, a bit more about this. But I think in the Ted Chiang stories, what I really, really liked about it, it was that it was just very dense, really good writing and very thoughtful. And it was just a short story.
About one thing.
About one thing. Yeah. It was like looking through a looking glass. It was like very narrow things. And I always was satisfied with it. I never thought like, oh, I could just stay more in this. Yeah.
There are other stories that he's written, like the merchant at the Alchemist Gate, I think is actually, that's kind of like novel stuff in a short story time. I actually think he gets much more out of it. There's some of the other stories that I think he gets almost novel amount of of storytelling and theme and character out of a quite short story.
Yeah.
Whereas this one, I don't think he does. I think it's kind of a long short story, but he doesn't get much.
I have more to say.
He doesn't get much out of it. Oh, okay. Well, you can check out this audiobook maybe on Audible. So go to audibletrial.com/SFBIP to check out this this audiobook. I mean, I'm not even sure it's on there, but you can do that, and by doing that you help support the podcast for bandwidth costs and also our reading and the books that we buy and read by checking out audibletrial.com/SFBIP and signing up for a free trial there, and even continuing a trial. But even just signing up for a free trial is enough to help support the podcast here. Who's at the door? Still nobody at the door.
It doesn't work.
Well, maybe go outside and look.
No, I'm not looking. Oh, okay. I'm not going outside. I'm not waiting for anything.
Okay, last thing is to say.
So I really recommend watching the movie. It was one of my most favourite science fiction movies so far. And I think it's also good for non-science fiction fans.
Yeah.
It's good for a broader audience.
Yeah.
And just a short story, I probably would not give 5 stars like I did with the collection that I actually read.
Yeah.
I think the reading the short story gives it a bit more background, a little bit more depth in both directions, especially the direction of the science. And I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I do think the short story fills in some of those gaps which were covered too quickly in the montage in the middle of the book. When you're like, no, but how do the aliens perceive it? It's just like, they can perceive all whatever at the same time. It's just like, the book goes into much more into that detail.
So I think both together makes a really good pair.
Movie first, book second.
Yeah, I kind of don't really want to rate them individually.
You know, the good thing is,
because I got them in a package.
Is because this is a movie podcast that we're doing now, and we never rate movies out of stars. We only rate novels, and we don't rate short story collections either, because it's too variable in short stories. So this actually will have no rating this episode. I'm just saying that
it goes together really well.
Yeah, they do go together really well. But I still don't. Weirdly enough, the short story is still only worth the 3 stars for me. Mainly because it's a short story, and I don't get enough out of a short story.
Yeah.
The movie filled in for me all that stuff which I was expecting, like all the flavour and the setting. Because in the short story, it's like, oh yeah, there's not even any spaceships there in orbit. Oh, and there's just a looking glass, and we can see them, and they can see us. And so it's like, okay, so you're just having a Skype conversation. And there's nothing movie-making about that, you know, like that little extract that we saw. It's sort of like, they can't just have a Skype conversation between them. They have to actually arrive on our doorstep. And the movie gave me all of that setup. Like, I know what it felt like to be there and to do that, because we went on that journey with people. And the book is just sort of like, well, This is a lot of info dumping and no colouring around the edges of background. You know, there's no setting. The setting is the relationship with her daughter and her feelings towards her daughter. And all of the actual science fiction-y stuff about meeting aliens and what they look like and the spaceship and the world, you know, that was in the movie. It was missing from the book. Yeah. And even when I read the book, it felt like that was missing. And then when I saw the movie, I was like, wow, that was really missing.
What I think is the genius thing about both of them is that they're really, really... individually have some flaws, but then when you put it together, you get just a more complete picture of it.
That's what I'm saying. My reading of the movie and why I could enjoy the movie so much was that I actually ignored what the movie said the movie was about.
Yes.
And just replaced what the movie said was about with what I thought the book was about. And in most ways it worked, and the bits that it doesn't work, I was like, I'm still okay with that, because literally this movie has made me cry 3 times in 10 minutes at the end. And that movie-making power maybe wouldn't have held up if I was only looking at the movie, but I already had a story that I wanted to be told to me in my head, and the movie did a good enough job of telling me the story that I wanted it to tell me, even though the movie itself wasn't telling me the story, and even the screenwriter said, no, we just changed it. Like, the book said she didn't have the choice. In the movie, I wanted her to have a choice. And I can still, like I say, I can still in my own headcanon rewrite the end of the movie to show that actually she didn't have the choice. And but what was so beautiful about the end of the movie was all the time up until that moment, it was like she was a single mother and she wasn't sharing the joy of having a child with everyone. It felt kind of like a lonely existence.
Yeah.
And even though we know in the future that they split up, but when that child leans over in bed and goes, Daddy, and it's such a cheesy moment, and it hit me so hard in the heart, it's all like, oh, this entire time it wasn't just her experiencing and loving her daughter, who she knows in the movie she knows is gonna die, and she, even if she does make a choice, she does that. But the moment of the daughter saying, Daddy, and the moment of the father saying, hey, little one, and also saying, hey, do you want a baby? All of that joy which is brought into the world by choosing to have a baby who they know is going to die at 15 years old time.
Yeah.
Even if she does make the choice, I wouldn't make that choice. But even if she did make the choice, I still emotionally understand how she feels and how she knows her husband's going to feel, even also knowing that in the future she's going to devastate him by telling her that the daughter's going to die when she's 15 years old of an incurable disease. And even though she knows she's going to go through that, it still works for me emotionally on the movie's own terms, even if I do think personally I would never have a child who I knew was going to die from an incurable disease at 15 years old. But then I think that might have something to do with me not wanting children anyway, you know.
Yeah.
But still, even as someone who has got no plans to have children and can't think of anything more devastating than having a child and them dying, whatever, at that age, it still hit me emotionally. The book never got anywhere to that.
The book wasn't quite that...
It was beautiful writing, but it just didn't have any emotional pack. But like I say, the movie, I have major issues with the storytelling and even some major issues with some of the movie making. But in the end, they become minor issues because how much it affected me emotionally.
Do it as a package. Watch the movie first, read the story, and then it will all be fine.
Yeah. Oh, I made another note here. Dr. Manhattan from Watchmen.
Yeah.
He's someone else who can see. He's like, you can see the future. It's like, I can only see my future. I only can see what's happening in my... Yeah. But, and I, if you want an exploration of someone who doesn't know where he is in time, because his perception can see forward and backwards, that's somebody else who was unstuck in time in a way that at some points he doesn't know where he is in his own story. There's a whole issue of him going, at this time I do this, at this time I do this, at this time I do this, at this time I do this.
And then she does this.
Yeah, and she does this and does that.
And so, because of that, she does this. It's good.
Dream sequence wasn't a dream sequence. That's why it's cut together weird. It was filmed as a different scene. Yeah, we mentioned that already. And
you should also watch this little YouTube video.
Yeah, it kind of explains why some of it was like that. Oh, yeah, and that's it. I've completed all my notes. Big question, is there a choice? And also...
Was this podcast inevitable?
Yes. Were we always going to do this podcast? You know what? Do you know what I think?
Yes.
Yeah, of course. Because I live my life as though I have free will, but also I live my life as though I don't have free will. I can never, and it's one of those things, I can't put both of these things in my brain at the same time. But intellectually, I know that nothing I am saying now I am deciding to say. And I know that because I have no intellectual control over what I am saying. And whenever you speak, you don't think. It's just happening. It's coming out
really, really slow.
You have thoughts, and now I'm thinking. Now I'm going to decide to say what I'm saying now, but I'm not. I'm not deciding that. There's nothing that I'm doing now to decide it. But that's only intellectual. But also, I have to believe that I have free choice because you would be mad. Yeah, because that's the only thing. The only way to live your life is to believe that you have free choice. But also, intellectually now, I know that I don't. And I can see in so many examples of my life where stuff happens. And I realize I never had a choice to do what I was doing there. There was nothing that I did. And I can even say, I am now choosing. No, and I don't have it. You know, a bit, maybe being a juggler helps that, because there's some stuff you just have no control over. And doesn't matter how much you think you're going to decide to do something, you just can't decide to do it.
If you do think about it, it's counterproductive.
Counterproductive. So, like I say, and it's so weird for me to be in that position where I have literally no belief in free will. But even that doesn't make sense, because what I believe about free will also has no impact on my life. Yeah. Because I know that I didn't come to a free will decision for me to believe in free will or not. You know, it's like being a white male person. My life situation of being white and male and living in Europe
has probably more to do than with your free will.
No, I'm just saying I had no choice in that either.
No,
like
nobody has.
Of the things that have brought me to literally doing a podcast, sitting talking about a movie and a short story, I've not made any choice. Like I can only, looking back in my life, can I convince myself that I have made any choices to get here. And intellectually, I know that's not true. But in the moment, you can't live like that. Otherwise, you lose the joy of life. Like, we have to trick ourselves into believing that we have a free choice or not. Because, I mean, that's it. That's the only way that we can live our lives. You know.
You know what?
What?
I'm now, on my free will, going to make myself an iced coffee and sit outside in the sun.
Okay, let's do it. Really? Or... are you only doing that because you've got a coffee machine that so many other people bought you, and that it's really warm outside and we have to have the windows closed, otherwise it's too noisy in here, which means it gets really hot.
I made myself some iced coffee yesterday and I want to drink it.
You've got some cold coffee that you want to put some ice cubes in.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And I made that decision yesterday. No, we have ice cream and I put chocolate chip ice cream.
Why do you have coffee left over from yesterday?
No, I made it specifically to make myself an iced coffee today.
Anyway.
On my own free will.
Yeah, you think that. My point is, it's the whole kind of thing. If you think your brain can understand what your brain is thinking, your brain isn't good enough to understand what your brain is thinking.
Yes.
And that's the kind of thing. It's an illusion of free will because we don't understand what's going on in our brains, and we don't understand all the situations that have led up to what we're doing now.
And why we're here.
And what ended up here like this.
And what's the meaning of life?
Looking back now, like I say, I can construct a really good story where I made lots of really good decisions in my life.
And bad decisions?
The thing is, you kind of put out of your mind the bad decisions. You say, bad decisions happened to me, but good decisions happened because of me. And it turns out, no, my brain is just the brain it is.
Yeah.
I didn't make a choice to have a different brain than my identical twin brother, but life happens to us, both of us, and now we have different brains and different stories and different lives.
Yeah.
We're a great control experiment. And anyway, so that's it. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.
Oh, follow me on email. Email me, luke@juggler.net, Twitter, I'm at Luke Burridge. Juliana is J-U-K-U Berlin. Yuku Berlin.
Yeah, Juliana, I will be on a podcast with Jesse when it comes out.
Whenever it comes out. You can follow me on Instagram, I'm at Luke Burridge there, and also YouTube. You can check out me and Juliana doing a vlog. If you're even remotely interested in juggling or anything performing like that, check out youtube.com/Luke Burridge. I think that gets you there anyway. And also sfbrp.com. You can check out this podcast episode notes, and also all the episode lists of past ones, and the archive feed, where you can find all of the episodes going all the way back from episode number 1 all the way through up to episode 300. And so you can listen to them in order easily in your podcast app by checking out the archive feed. No, really, that's it for now. Thanks a lot. See you later.
Goodbye.
Catch you next time.
Goodbye.
Yeah.
Now let me have the last word.
You know, you're much better interrupting me than I am at interrupting you. Because when I interrupt you, I just start talking and you go, no. When you interrupt me, you just hold your finger up in front of me and I stop talking and look at you and then you carry on. I'm like, I didn't finish my point, but I thought you were going to say something to do with my point. But actually, you just move on, and then I'm going to go, okay, now putting aside what Juliana said, now I'm going to go back and finish my point. But the way I do it sounds really bad because I just start talking to comment on what you're saying, and you hold your finger up and interrupt me. But it feels like you're being really nice and waiting for me to stop talking. But actually, what you're doing, you're just holding your finger up and then I'm just stopping. So.
Yes, I'm a very nice, polite person, and yeah. I now want to say goodbye to people. Let me say goodbye to people.
Yeah, but the point is that you interrupted me just as many times as I interrupted you in that podcast. But you do it inaudibly by holding your finger and you sound really polite, and I do it by just starting talking to move on with the conversation. Yeah, it is. It's inaudible, but it's just one of those things that it's really funny to see, because you're like, you keep interrupting me, and then after three minutes later, you're interrupting me, but you do it by putting your finger up. So I thought that was quite funny.
Okay,
that's it for me.
Let's say goodbye.
Yeah, catch you later.